Welcome to the Changing Climate of the American West, a regional call-in special. I'm Larry Mantle of NPR member station KPCC in Los Angeles. This morning, we're connecting public radio stations in Colorado, Arizona, Nevada, and California. We're inviting listeners throughout the West to call in with ways they see climate change most affecting their state. We'll talk with reporters from NPR stations carrying this live broadcast. And we'll also examine the climate proposals from the 2020 presidential candidates. It's the Changing Climate of the American West, a regional call-in special. We'll start right after the news. Welcome to the Changing Climate of the American West, a regional call-in special. I'm Larry Mantle of NPR member station KPCC in Los Angeles. We're linking public radio listeners in Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, and California. Our broadcast is part of the national week-long journalism project, Covering Climate Now. The purpose of this regional call-in special is twofold: to hear what each state is facing in specific climate challenges and to assess the differences between the 2020 presidential candidates' climate change proposals. What specific proposals would you like to hear from the candidates? And is there a candidate who dovetails with your priorities? If so, is she or he giving you enough detail on how they would pass and implement their plan? Our regional call-in number is 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. You can also tweet using the hashtag #CoveringClimateNow. Now, we begin with KPCC Los Angeles science reporter Jacob Margolis. Jacob, good to have you with us. Let's talk first about California, and what do climate scientists say is one of the biggest concerns with the changing climate here?
Yeah, we're looking at wildfires, and wildfires have clearly been in the news the past several years. Really, the last 20, Cal Fire keeps a running list of the last 20 largest fires. Currently, 16 of those have occurred since 1999. Like, that's a lot. And that part of that has to do with urbanization. The more that we've urbanized, pushed into urban wildland interface, they become more destructive. And, you know, flashback to, you know, even last year, we're talking about the Camp Fire, where an entire town of Paradise was lost. So these things can be absolutely catastrophic.
And we see the effects of prolonged drought. California has been throughout its history subject to extreme periods of drought, but we've seen some of the most intensive ones on record recently.
Yeah, absolutely. And as climate change progresses, there's indications that we will swing back and forth between periods, long periods of dryness and short, intense periods of wetness. And what we saw during the Thomas Fire a few years ago, which burned pretty much all the way into the ocean, I mean, in December, which was crazy during our rainy season, was that we came off a period of drought, got a lot of rain. All of a sudden, all this vegetation grew up, and then it stayed dry during our rainy season. All of a sudden, it was there to burn, and it was there to take out all of this old growth plants, too, that hadn't been burned for a long time. And then, of course, you get into the whole discussion of forest management.
Well, and let's talk about that, because I think people throughout the nation have heard about some of the leading edge climate policies coming out of the California legislature. But in terms of fire prevention or resources deployed for future fires, how's the state responding there?
Yeah, forest management, prescribed burns, all that kind of stuff. It's at the forefront of all of the concerns for Cal Fire and forest management. There's a huge debate around it. But I think that we kind of need to take it to the local kind of person building out in the middle of the forest level as well, and talk about, especially here in Los Angeles, we have a lot of people that build in areas that we know burn. For those people, they need to consider fireproofing their home as much as possible, which means clearing brush, clearing any trees, anything like that, and of course, making it easy for firefighters to get to them, because this will be a bigger concern going forward.
All right, Jacob, we'll talk a little bit later in the hour about the presidential candidates and their climate change proposals. Jacob Margolis covers science and the environment for KPCC, NPR member station in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Changing Climate of the American West, a regional call-in special. I'm Larry Mantle of KPCC in Los Angeles. We're linking listeners in Nevada, Colorado, Arizona, and California, part of the week-long journalism project covering climate now. And you can tweet your thoughts about your local community, how you're most seeing the effects of climate change, and what your local officials are talking about as their biggest concerns for the place where you live and work. You can tweet using the hashtag #CoveringClimateNow. You can also call us and speak with fellow listeners throughout the American West, 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. We're also asking reporters throughout the region that we're covering with this conversation today to share with us what's happening in their communities. And we welcome Colorado Public Radio energy and environmental reporter Grace Hood. Grace, here in California, the state legislature has passed aggressive targets for limiting carbon emissions. What sorts of climate measures have been discussed or passed in Colorado?
You know, we've had a very active session that wrapped up in the spring. For example, we had a climate action plan that was passed by state Democrats to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 90% by 2050. Also bills to increase electric vehicle adoption and the establishment of one of the first in the country just transition offices from coal-based electrical energy economy. So that gives grants and things like that to coal workers.
Given that you've got an economy which is at least in part reliant on energy extraction with oil and gas, how are the competing interests playing out in the legislature?
Well, it's very interesting. One of the most contentious bills this past session was to shore up regulations for the oil and gas industry. And a lot of those focused on health and safety, but there's also going to be rules that will make Colorado methane emissions from oil and gas equipment even more strict. We already have some of the strictest in the country, and it's a really interesting narrative. While at the state level, at the federal level, things are really being rolled back. For example, the EPA methane rule related to oil and gas, Colorado's really doubling down on what was already some of the strictest regulations in the country for oil and gas and methane.
Let's also talk about tourism, another big industry for your state of Colorado. We've got everything from ski resort, vacationing centers in the Rockies, to other areas where you're reliant on people coming for the outdoors. What are some of the concerns about those industries, snowpack, water availability, the like?
Absolutely. Well, I think, your previous reporter just set things up so nicely. I mean, when you're talking about wildfires or even drought, for example, last summer we had pretty severe wildfires and that steered some tourists away from the state. But then think about the ski industry. Mountain ecosystems are among the most vulnerable to climate alterations. And climate change is only going to exacerbate kind of existing problems with snowpack, which some years is quite low.
All right, Grace, thank you so much for filling us in on how Colorado is talking about climate change and its future effects. Grace Hood, energy and environmental reporter at Colorado Public Radio based in Denver. You're listening to The Changing Climate of the American West, an hour-long regional call-in special. I'm Larry Mantle of NPR member station KPCC in Los Angeles. We're hearing from listeners throughout the West in Arizona, Nevada, Colorado, and California. This part of the week-long journalism project from coast to coast covering climate now. You can tweet using that hashtag covering climate now. Let's talk with Mark, who's listening to KJZZ in Phoenix, Arizona. Mark, thanks very much. Your thoughts about what you'd like to hear from the 2020 candidates.
Well, you asked about the local changes that I've seen. When I was young, I don't remember seeing a whole lot of 120 degree summers, and now they're pretty common. Lake Powell gets low, and it scares the bejesus out of me. But I get worried about apocryphal stories of local climate change because climate change is global, and I hope that's not lost. The reason I'm calling in is because I hope that the candidates would listen to your show or you could get to them to really embrace nuclear. As I look at it, if they aren't embracing nuclear, they're simply not being honest or realistic with attacking climate change, and especially some of the newer technologies like molten salt reactors that are coming online, they should know about it. If they don't and they have a big benefit, they don't blow up.
Mark, I appreciate your call. As you might know, New Jersey's Cory Booker has been one of the candidates who's a proponent of nuclear, and he says the other candidates aren't being realistic if nuclear isn't part of the mix. It provides about 20% of electricity production throughout the country right now, and Booker says that's got to be part of the mix if you're going to get to zero carbon emissions. Mark, I appreciate it very much. Let's talk with Chris. Joining us in Modesto, California, listening to Capital Public Radio out of Sacramento. Chris, what's your biggest concern locally?
My biggest concern locally has to do with water. I've lived in the Central Valley for about 14 years, and I've seen a transition from flood irrigation. There's a lot of almonds grown out here, which are very water intensive, and other crops. We've seen lots of areas cleared out and they're using drip irrigation, but it doesn't seem to be happening at as fast as pace as possible. And I'm just curious because that seems to be a resource that we're, you know, basically letting evaporate. And I think that water scarcity as things get worse with climate change is going to be coming more and more to the forefront because of how many things in the food chain it affects.
I know here in Southern California that our water agencies are providing rebates and financial support for people to do rainwater capture, to move to drip irrigation in some places, Chris. But yes, that's often done very localized, and it depends on, you know, what sorts of dollars are set aside to do that, because moving to drip irrigation, for example, depending on the size of the property, can be an expensive endeavor. Chris, calling us from Modesto, listening to Capital Public Radio. This is the Changing Climate of the American West, a regional call-in special as we take this hour, 10 o'clock Pacific, 11 o'clock Mountain, to talk about what's happening in your local community with climate change and some of the ways that local and state bodies are taking this on to try and deal with it. Let's talk next from Capital Public Radio's environmental reporter, Ezra Romero. Ezra, thanks very much. Quickly before we break, share with us what the planning process is for Lake Tahoe, the state of California's biggest lake, adapting to climate change.
Yes, we have a podcast all about this called Tahoe Land. And in this podcast, we're talking about how everything is changing there, every level of society, everything from more rain instead of snow, more wildfires, and even a lake that could turn green. All these are the effects of climate change, and it's affecting everything from where low-income workers can live and how they get around to casinos to the lake itself. It's just really affecting Tahoe's winter identity as a place of tourism.
And we'll talk about that with Ezra Romero of Capital Public Radio in Sacramento as we continue. The Sierra Nevada, our huge tourist destination along California and Nevada's border. You're listening to the Changing Climate of the American West. We'll be back with you in 1 minute. This is the Changing Climate of the American West, a regional call-in special. Good morning. I'm Larry Mantle of NPR member station KPCC Los Angeles. We're hearing from listeners throughout the public radio audiences of Arizona, Nevada, Colorado, and California, talking about the biggest climate concerns in their communities: water supply, wildfires, agriculture, the cost of energy, sea level rise, snowpack, increasing ozone levels, wildlife habitats. Those are just a few of the many concerns throughout the West. And we're talking about how state and local officials and presidential candidates are responding. Like to hear from you as you talk with your fellow listeners throughout the West on public radio stations. Call us with your thoughts about the impact of climate change in your community specifically. We're at 866-893-5722. 866-893-5722. If you'd prefer to tweet, please use the hashtag Covering Climate Now. That's the title of a week-long journalism series done by print and broadcast and online journalists all this week across the United States. Right now, we're talking with Capital Public Radio reporter Ezra Romero, covers the environment out of Sacramento, also hosts the podcast that Cap Public Radio does, Tahoe Land. You were talking about concerns, even the changing of water color and water quality at Tahoe. But what about the ski resorts in the Sierra Nevada, Ezra? How are they preparing?
Yeah, so with climate change, snow is one of the largest things that climate change is affecting. It means more rain instead of snow, or just these really extreme years where we have these 5 or 6 years of drought, and then the biggest snowpack on record. So these extremes, this lack of snow instead of rain, and having rain instead, is challenging ski resorts, mom-and-pop groups that all need snow to exist. So for some, like the mom-and-pop sleigh ride company, they're going out of business or having to rebrand themselves as a carriage ride company. But then the larger ski resorts are adapting by making snow. But the ones that don't have as much money, they're just having to wait till they feel the pain even more, or they'll just go out of business altogether. So it's sort of the lack of snow or the overabundance of snow is challenging Tahoe's winter identity, meaning that they're having to reinvent themselves because summers are getting longer in places like Lake Tahoe. And so like the summer recreation time is they're trying to capitalize on that. And so there's all these groups that want to open these businesses and get remote workers up there and all that kind of stuff.
So someone who could actually benefit from a warming climate. Ezra, thank you very much for talking with us about your reporting. It's with Capital Public Radio in Sacramento and hosts Capital Public Radio's Tahoe Land podcast about Lake Tahoe. Once again, we welcome your calls from throughout the West, whether you're listening in Las Vegas, Phoenix, Denver, listening in Sacramento, San Diego, the Central Valley of California, from the Rockies through the desert areas of southern Nevada, 866-893-5722, or tweet with the hashtag covering climate now. Let's take another call from listener Jan in Camino, California, listening on Capital Public Radio out of Sacramento. Jan, thank you very much. What's the biggest concern in your community?
Biggest concern in my community, we are a relatively forested community. We are in the foothills of the Sierra in Northern California. And the biggest concern is having common sense practices, really looking through how to prepare for fire proactively ahead of time. Some of the ideas that have been floated over the last couple of years are concerning. The main one is the idea of thinning the forest so that there's 10 feet between the tops of trees. Which sounds, you know, like maybe that would help with fire protection. Cal Fire is my neighbor, and I've spoken with them and discussed it with them.
That's the state fire agency here.
Correct. And everyone seems to agree that if a wildfire gets going, that won't really help any more than any other type of clearing. The problem I see with it on my property, I have 4 acres of forest, and I aggressively cleared in an area just above my home, thinking that I would be better off doing that.
Yeah.
Previously, all we did was to remove brush and then get the branches, you know, trim the branches,
so,
anything dead, and then high up off the ground.
Jan, I'm so sorry because I got so many callers, but I appreciate you're talking about the lengths to which you're going on the property you own to try and control for fire. But I know there's debate about what are the best methods to pursue, and all of them come with significant costs. That's Jan in Camino, California. Also joining us is Dylan Simard, who's sustainability reporter for Cronkite News, news division of Arizona Public Broadcasting. Dylan, thank you for being with us.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. So talk with us about the biggest concerns in the deserts of Arizona.
Well, I don't think I'm really rocking the boat by saying that Phoenix is a very hot city, but in 2014, there were 61 heat-related deaths in Maricopa County. 2018, the number was 182.
Wow.
It's over time steadily getting hotter here, and a lot of these heat-related deaths are probably going to be exacerbated in a future that will eventually also get hotter for Phoenix.
Yeah, so, and the expenditures, I'm assuming, to try and mitigate for that, whether it's protections for parked cars or giving people places that might be safe along the street that they could seek shelter. Are those sorts of things being discussed?
So there's a research group over at Arizona State University that's evaluating different types of shade and then comparing them relative to each other for how those might be funded and how effective they are at actually blocking shade and how people experience heat. And what they're finding is that as this research is influencing the cities and how they're planning for a hot future, things like artificial shade awnings are far superior than regular trees to block shade and
Expensive that. To do that, yeah. Dylan, thank you so much. Sustainability reporter for Cronkite News, a news division of Arizona PBS. Let's stay in Arizona. Talk with senior correspondent for NPR member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Brett Jaspers. Brett, good morning. What in the greater Phoenix area is top of mind?
Well, one thing that I cover is water. And as Grace was saying before, with snowpack kind of going down, the implication for Arizonans is that there's less water going into the tributaries of the Colorado River and then the reservoirs of the Colorado River, just like Lake Mead and Lake Powell, like the caller kind of mentioned before. He was concerned about Lake Powell. So, a declining snowpack really does kind of mean people in Arizona have to think a lot harder about their water use.
What about the costs associated with water use in Arizona?
Well, it's very complicated, and every different municipality or jurisdiction has their own portfolio of water, be it groundwater or from the Colorado or from some in-state rivers. However, the city of Phoenix, just as an example, last year approved water rate increases, and this was mostly to make sure they could get groundwater from one part of the city into the northern part of the city, which receives a lot of Colorado River water. So the rate increase is 6% in 2019 and 6% in 2020. So that's just one example, the city of Phoenix. But, the price of water, people have told me that will go up. It's just a matter of time.
All right. Brett Jaspers, thanks very much. And just quickly, agriculture in Arizona. I think many people who don't live in Arizona don't realize the size of the ag business there. What are the concerns there about rising heat?
Oh, well, water use and for agricultural use is 74% of our Colorado River water. So different farming regions have different, different situations in terms of how much water they're entitled to and how strong their water right is. But, there are some farmers in the central part of the state that are really feeling the heat with the decrease in Colorado River water that everybody's expecting in the years to come.
Brett, thanks so much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
From NPR member station KJZZ in Phoenix, senior correspondent Brett Jaspers, you're listening to The Changing Climate of the American West, a regional call-in special. We're connecting listeners from throughout the West, describing the biggest climate concerns in their communities. Just a few of the concerns in the West we've talked about. There are many others I'm sure you'd like to bring to our attention, to your fellow public radio listeners throughout the region. We're taking your calls 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. You can also tweet using the hashtag Covering Climate Now. That's the title of a week-long series of coordinated journalism that's been done by broadcasters, print, online news gatherers, and commentators all this week, bringing attention to the climate. And as you might well be aware, more than 800 rallies have been scheduled today across the country. The Global Climate Strike, as it's called, being led by students already throughout Europe, portions of Asia. There have been gatherings of varying sizes to protest what the organizers say is global inaction or insufficient action when it comes to climate change. This was inspired by the activism of Swedish teenager Greta Thunberg. Once again, 866-893-5722. From Boulder, Colorado, listening to NPR member station KUNC. Jay, you're concerned about your community.
Yes, I'm concerned here in the Rocky Mountains. The quality of water has greatly diminished, even though we'll have record snowpacks, as your previous callers have mentioned, and then followed by droughts, all the way from the Front Range to high up on the Continental Divide at 14,000 feet. I've noticed personally an increase in algae levels, a decrease in oxygen in the water, which affects, you know, all the marine insects, fish, etc., and then also just the level of heavy metals and toxicity in the water from either whether it was mining or, you know, some sort of industrial process has also greatly increased. And I think it's important that we address the water, not just in Lake Tahoe, but all over the country, because that's a key to life.
Jay, do you feel like the Colorado legislature or your city officials in Boulder are grappling with this sufficiently? Are they talking about concrete ways of mitigating the effects locally?
No, unfortunately. You know, being here in Boulder, the city itself and the county is, you know, it really presents itself as economic and environmentally progressive. But, you know, as far as like boots on the ground goes and actual policy changes, I have not seen anything. And, you know, a lot of the water table around here has been terribly polluted by the processes of mining, whether it be the extraction or the process of chemicals being introduced to, you know, separate the ore from the earth that's taken out of a mine. And, you know, streams at 13, 14,000 feet. Hmm. Orange and red and look like there's oil all over them.
Jay, I appreciate your call. Thank you for sharing what you've observed in Boulder, Colorado. Listening to NPR member station KUNC, Colorado Public Radio is a part of this regional broadcast connecting listeners in southern Nevada, in Arizona, California, and Colorado. Sandy, listening to KNPR Las Vegas. Sandy, thanks very much. What are you seeing in southern Nevada?
Hey there. Yeah, I worked for TSA for about 7 years until the last government shutdown. But anyway, I noticed more airplanes being grounded because of the heat levels. And so I feel like more planes being grounded, not being able to take off because of the heat levels, it will affect tourism in the long run.
And do you know what the threshold is of temperature that you have to ground planes?
I believe it's over 111, like 115, somewhere around there. There's just, they can't take off after a certain temperature. I'm not quite sure the exact number, but it has seemed to have been more planes grounded.
All right. And in your city, that's huge, given the significance of McCarran Airport. Sandy, thank you for calling us from Las Vegas, listening to NPR member station KNPR. With us from San Diego's KPBS environmental reporter, Eric Anderson. Eric, good morning. San Diego, what's one of the biggest issues?
Well, we have 70 miles of coastline here in San Diego County. And as you can imagine, as sea levels rise, that puts pressure on residences and businesses along the coast. In the southern part of the county, Imperial Beach is a low-lying community that's already grappling with some impacts of sea level rise. They had a storm back in January during the King tides that really kind of washed over that community and created flooding. So that's something that they're already having to deal with. A little further to the north, we have a lot of coastal bluffs and houses on top of those bluffs. And the rising sea levels are starting to undercut those bluffs and putting those houses in peril, and it's forcing local officials to consider plans of action around that. And infrastructure is in the way. San Diego's airport, an international airport, is in a low-lying area next to San Diego Bay. So as the water levels rise, it kind of puts that particular economic engine in peril.
We're talking with NPR member station KPBS reporter Eric Anderson, who covers the environment throughout San Diego County. I was also wondering about some of the human-made parts of San Diego County. Mission Bay, for example, dredged out of the wetlands there and created. Are some of those areas particularly susceptible to sea level rise?
I think they all face different challenges. One thing about Mission Bay, which used to be that big wetland area that would kind of serve as a buffer for the coast, those wetlands are not there anymore. There's an effort in the northern edge of San Diego or Mission Bay to kind of restore some of that wetland to create that buffer. But I think that everybody just kind of looks at the coast, and there's a recognition locally here that this is an issue that needs to be considered and dealt with. But everybody just kind of looks at the coast and considers the future and thinks about how they might have to adjust to accommodate how the planet's climate is changing.
In some of the North County communities like Del Mar, where there is a threat from seawater intrusion, are there discussions of seawalls or other mitigation plans and what the cost for that would be?
Sure. There are a lot of discussions, as you can imagine, among private homeowners, among city officials there. And I think the real challenge for a lot of those communities with coastal assets that are under strain or under risk is that, you know, where does the city's responsibility lie? Where do the private property owner's responsibility lie? Obviously, if you have a blufftop home, where the ocean is starting to undercut that bluff and potentially your property could tumble in, you want to do what you can, but you can't do it in and of yourself. You can't just arbitrarily put some kind of armoring along the coast to protect that bluff. There are processes you have to go through. The city of Del Mar is, you know, looking at a neighborhood that might be underwater in 15 years. How do you deal with the property values there? That's a big concern for the people who have very expensive homes in that area. So a lot of these issues are being discussed and talked about, but I don't think we're anywhere close to what the appropriate resolution would be.
Eric, good to talk with you. Thanks so much. Eric Anderson, environmental reporter at NPR member station KPBS San Diego, which covers the entire county. Just one of the many stations over which you're hearing the changing climate of the American West, a regional call-in special. I'm Larry Mantle of NPR member station KPCC in Los Angeles. We're bringing together listeners and reporters from Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, and California. This part of the national week-long journalism project Covering Climate Now. You can use the hashtag Covering Climate Now to tweet what's happening in your community or what local officials are considering in the way of future climate threats. You can also call, as those who will be joining us momentarily have done, 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. We've got some tweets that I'll be sharing coming up momentarily. We'll continue with our regional call-in special in 1 minute. This is the changing climate of the American West, a regional call-in special heard on public radio stations in Colorado, Arizona, Nevada, and California. We're hearing some of the specific challenge of climate change in each part of the southwestern United States and talking about some of the differences in the 2020 presidential candidates' climate platforms, which we'll get to momentarily. Let me share some listener comments. Doug joins us from a town north San Juan, close to Paradise, California. He's listening to Capital Public Radio out of Sacramento. It says, my concern living near Paradise is that insurance companies are raising rates for everyone because of the wildfire threat. We've invested thousands of dollars in clearing vegetation and trees around our house. Claire in Phoenix says, I live in an area up against the mountains, and because of heavy rains, we've had mudslides coming into my house. Climate change is a huge concern for us. Meg in Ojai in Ventura County of Southern California, listening on KPCC, talking about the need to consider the reintroduction of beavers to the West. They help sequester water and wonder if they could be helpful to the environment. William in Nyland, listening to KPBS San Diego. I teach and do hang gliding. I've seen a real change in weather over the last 40 years. The winds have become far more extreme. That I see as a result of climate change. And William says, I don't think any of the candidates have been serious enough about addressing it. So there's a something in industry or recreation you wouldn't even think about climate change having an effect. William seeing it with hang gliding. Bonnie listening in Mesa, Arizona, the east side, Maricopa County, listening to KJZZ Phoenix. The air quality, the Valley of the Sun's been terrible. We have record hot days, record numbers of bad air quality days. We also see fewer birds, and we have cricket invasions. I think it has to do with the escalating heat. That's Bonnie calling from Mesa, Arizona. You can once again share your comment by calling us at 866-893-5722 or tweet using the hashtag covering climate now. Let's talk next with from the Central Valley, listener Julie, who joins us from Davis, listening to Capital Public Radio. Julie, briefly, what are you seeing in your community?
Hi, I live in the Central Valley where there are lots of dairies and pastures where cows and sheep are raised, and I'm really concerned that animal agriculture is a leading cause of greenhouse gas emissions, and we don't talk about that. We use a lot of water, and there's a lot of water pollution that's associated with animal ag, and it's really inefficient to grow food to feed these animals, and then we turn around and eat those animals and their products. I just think that's crazy.
Well, Julie, the economy, though, of the area you live in is heavily dependent on agriculture, and dairy's a part of that, too. So you think that your area would be able to economically sustain fewer dairies?
Well, absolutely. The economy is dependent on that. And just as Michigan has been highly dependent on the auto industry for a long time, and Appalachia has been highly dependent on coal. So we need to think now, what can we do to help these people? Absolutely. We don't want to leave them high and dry, so to speak. What can we do to help them transition?
All right, Julie, I appreciate it. Calling from Davis, listening to Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Joining me now is Nevada Public Radio staff writer and reporter Heidi Kaiser, who joins us from Las Vegas. Heidi, thanks so much for being with us. How's the Nevada State Legislature taking on climate?
Yeah, some folks are actually calling this past legislative session that ended in June the Clean Energy Summit, because so much legislation was passed having to do with clean energy and climate change in general. And there were something like 18 pro-conservation bills that passed, including several directly related to climate change. The big one was a carbon reduction planning mandate that has a goal of 28%, a reduction of 28% in greenhouse gas emissions by 2025 and a 45% reduction by 2030. And the state has a mandate now to set a plan to get there and to report on the state's progress every year. And then in addition, there was an increase in our renewable portfolio standard from 25% by 2025 to 50% by 2030 and 100% renewable energy by 2050. So those are just two of the big ones, but there were several clean energy and conservation bills that passed this session.
Given tourism is an economic behemoth in Las Vegas, what are some of the ways that the larger properties are dealing with the effects of climate change or even potentially escalating electricity costs in the future?
Well, Mandalay Bay installed its own solar array on its roof several years ago, and hotel properties up and down the strip have had various climate change or sustainability plans for a decade or more in some cases. But interestingly, in regards to the climate protest that's happening today or the walkout, the students in Las Vegas who are protesting are gathered in front of the Venetian as a means of protesting that hotel's resistance to getting on the climate change fight.
Interesting. So they've gone right to one of the most visible properties along the strip to do that. Las Vegas, of course, as it has built up as much as any city in the West over the past couple of decades, you've seen a temperature increase there, too, because of these essentially the concrete effect.
Yeah, that's probably the most visible or the most stark indication of what's happening here is like people talk anecdotally about it getting hotter, but we can really feel it here. We had a record number of days over 105 degrees in August. A study by Climate Central earlier this year found that Las Vegas is the fastest warming city in the United States. Our temperature has risen 5.76 degrees since 1970. And there was another study that projected we're going to have something like nearly 100 days of temperatures over 100 degrees by 2100 if we continue on the current trajectory. So, you know, these are things we've just got constant ozone warnings and record. I know that Dylan mentioned people dying from heat-related illnesses. And, you know, we're seeing the same thing here. There was almost doubled the number of people dying from heat-related illnesses in 2017 compared to 2016. And so yeah. We can really feel it.
Yeah, understandably. Heidi, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Heidi Kaiser, staff writer and reporter, Nevada Public Radio, KJZZ, NPR member station in Las Vegas. Joining us now is Matthew, calling us from Tucson. Matthew, what have you witnessed as the effects of climate change?
Yeah, thanks for giving me the opportunity to share a story from the perspective of the Arizona Trail Association. We're a nonprofit organization that helps manage an 800-mile national scenic trail from Mexico to Utah, and it passes through a variety of climates, mountains and canyons and forests and deserts. And what we're seeing, of course, is not just disappearing water sources, which is a huge concern for anybody who's recreating outdoors, but also the wildfire season has essentially doubled. Typically, when we were looking at wildfires and when to plan for them and trail closures, we were usually looking at really kind of May through September. Now we're seeing fires start in March and then running through as late as October. And I think a lot of us take our natural resources and parks and canyons and forests for granted, and we just assume that they're there. But they're a massive contributor to Arizona's economy. $21 billion is the most recent figure. And although it's not all about the economy, it's an important conversation to have. That without recreational resources like these trails and forests, which affects climate change, we'll see a complete collapse in the economy of Arizona.
Matthew, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for talking about that and what a huge industry recreation is throughout Arizona. You're listening to The Changing Climate of the American West, a regional call-in special. I'm Larry Mantle of NPR member station KPCC in Los Angeles. We're linking public radio listeners in Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, and California, this part of a national week-long journalism project covering climate now. You can share your comments via Twitter using the hashtag covering climate now, or you can call us with your comment about what your local community is dealing with in climate specific change at 866-893-5722. And I want to correct my mistake. I just mentioned Heidi at Nevada Public Radio. You, of course, know your NPR member station is KNPR. I know that. Listen to it all the time when I'm in southern Nevada. So my apologies for making that mistake. Let's talk with more listeners. This one is from San Diego, KPBS listener Denise. Denise, share with us your thoughts.
Yes, here in San Diego, we actually are experiencing the effects of climate change with decreased wildlife corridors and increase in wildfire risk. And, you know, here in San Diego, we're at a crossroads because while we are experiencing these climate change issues, we also have an unprecedented pressure on elected officials to build market rate housing in the suburban areas. And these areas obviously contribute to climate change with increased GHGs and closing off wildlife corridors and putting pressure on water supplies, et cetera. And we need to, you know, if we were going to do something about climate change, we really need to figure out this whole housing climate balance.
And as you laid it out beautifully, Denise, because it is a huge challenge in throughout California. This is an issue where there's a housing shortage. And then the question is, where do you construct? And can you come up with enough infill units to meet demand? Or do you need to build more in open spaces? A number of large developments are proposed throughout L.A., San Diego, and Orange counties in the Inland Empire as well. And how do you balance that with the very environmental concerns that you're expressing? Let's talk next with Santa Santan Valley, Arizona. Resident Ellen listening on KJZZ and Arizona Public Radio. Ellen, what's the biggest problem you're seeing in your part of Arizona?
Well, the increased heat. It's been unbearable. And every year, we've lived here since 2002. The heat has become so such a factor. A factor in your daily activity, your daily comfort. Yes, we've had multiple heat deaths too, but the air is so dirty. We've had monsoon winds, no rain, basically, this summer. So the air alert days have become so frequent. I can't really think of too many days when you don't hear an air alert warning and the ozone warning here where we live.
It's hard to imagine Arizona without monsoonal rains in August and September. Do you recall previous years like that?
No. No, this has been extreme. There's just no rain. I mean, I think we might have had one little bit of sprinkle where I live in Santan Valley, but not much else. And I think the other problem, of course, for Arizona and for the country is water shortage. And I think that people are not trying hard enough, especially the HOAs, who turn their watering systems on, which are sprinklers that, you know, go across in arcing streams of water, and they water anytime from noon to 5 or 5:30.
Yeah, water usage huge in so much of the West, talking about the Homeowner Association from some of those communities, planned communities in Arizona. Ellen, thank you very much. You're listening to The Changing Climate of the American West, a regional call-in special. I'm Larry Mantle of NPR member station KPCC in Los Angeles. Also joining me is Jacob Margolis, KPCC science reporter. Jacob, I want to take a few minutes here just to talk briefly about the 2020 presidential candidates. And we know that there is a significant amount of alignment between them on policies, but there are some differences too. Bernie Sanders, for example, the most fiscally ambitious, with a huge outlay to try and change reliance on fossil fuels.
Yeah, by far, $16 trillion, actually. A lot of the other candidates are around 5 or 10. You know, all of the candidates agree, like Green New Deal, in theory, good idea, although there's debate over how to implement different parts. They all agree that we should rejoin the Paris Climate Accords. That's a very symbolic thing. When you get down into the details, you can start to see that Sanders and Warren are really hot on curbing emissions, zeroing out emissions by 2030. The other candidates are shooting for 2050. That 2050 deadline is a big deal. We're supposed to go negative emissions basically after 2050 to hopefully prevent 1.5 degrees warming. A lot of scientists argue that, though, that's already baked in. If you break it down even further into nuclear energy, which we addressed earlier, you know, Sanders is the most no. Warren is against new plants. All the other candidates think that it has a role to play. You know, you get down into other issues like farming practices and whatnot that get a little bit more wonky. O'Rourke is someone that I heard talk about actually, you know, incentives for farmers to plant cover crops, which can sequester carbon.
All right. Very good, Jacob. Thanks so much. Let's talk next with Eric joining us from Phoenix, listening to NPR member station KJZZ. Eric, I understand you're a lifelong Phoenix resident. What changes have you seen?
Well, for the most part, as somebody who's been here for a very long time, it is getting hotter and drier. Phoenix is typically well known for the monsoon season. They always talk about it. It's always played in the radio and TV. And the truth of the matter is, for the last 4 or 5 years, we do not have much of a monsoon season. We will get rain, or I'm sorry, we will get wind, and we will get dust, and we will get storms, but we do not get water in the city part of the valley. I mean, we will wait for this all year, and they talk about the big monsoon season that comes. And as a previous caller mentioned, it is hotter, and those big storms that come during the summer just do not give water. They'll yeah. give lightning, which will make fire, and they'll give rain and dust. But with the heat that keeps getting more and more, we just do not get rain in.
Not enough inches of rain. And as I'm sure you know from following the news on KJZZ, you know that the ongoing discussions over Colorado River water is a huge thing, and Arizona trying to get its share. California's, of course, the behemoth there with taking Colorado River water. And Eric, sounds like you're just concerned long-term as your city has grown significantly about that resource.
Phoenix does continue to grow and expand, and there is a lot of talk about trying to conserve certain things, but the water usage of Phoenix is a very big concern, and it's just going to get worse as the years go on. As rain goes down, population goes up. Colorado River is not going to be able to cover it all.
All right. Eric, thanks so much for joining us from Phoenix. Dixie Lee, listening on Capital Public Radio, that we had a fire just a very short distance from me. I'm older. I have no transportation. I'm concerned that our town is just like paradise. I'm older, limited in what I can do, and I would like to see our local officials spend more time and resources helping older people clear their properties to help prevent the threat of wildfire. That's Dixie Lee in North San Juan listening to Capital Public Radio. And Kyler calls from Sacramento listening to Capital Public Radio, says, I'm originally from Ventura where the Thomas Fire burned such a huge swath. My neighbor's house burned to the ground. I've seen fires get worse and worse. And with Santa Ana winds, it creates a perfect storm. So Kyler in Sacramento talking about his concerns in Southern California. Want to thank all of our listeners who've joined us from throughout the American West. Many thanks to Colorado Public Radio, KJZZ in Phoenix, KNPR in Las Vegas, KPBS in San Diego, Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, and Cronkite News, part of Elemental, a regional collaboration on sustainability. All of them joining for the Changing Climate of the American West, a regional call-in special. And we welcome your continued conversation with your fellow listeners to public radio stations here in the West. You can do so by tweeting using the hashtag #CoveringClimateNow. Thank you so much for being part of this special broadcast on public radio stations in the West. I'm Larry Mantle of NPR station KPCC in Los Angeles. Have a good weekend. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. I'm joined by film critics Wade Major of Cinegods.com, Claudia Puig, film critic, as well as president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, and Charles Solomon, film critic with Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. First up this week is Ad Astra, a drama directed by James Gray, who co-wrote the screenplay with Ethan Gross. Brad Pitt stars as an astronaut embarking on a journey across the galaxy in search of his missing father.
What can you tell us about the Lima Project?
First manned expedition to the outer solar system, sir. Some 29 years ago.
And the commander was?
He was my father, sir. The ship disappeared approximately 16 years into the mission. No data was ever recovered. Deep space missions were halted after that.
Roy, we have something that might come as quite a shock to you. We believe your father is still alive near Neptune.
Ad Astra, Wade?
I am admittedly biased. I've known James Gray for nearly 30 years, and I think the world of him as a filmmaker. He was an amazing filmmaker as a student, and he's even better now. I think this is James' best film. James has made some great films, and he has a great love for Stanley Kubrick, which comes out in this film in ways that have not necessarily come out in previous films. Effectively, what he's doing is he is taking Heart of Darkness or Apocalypse Now, whichever variation you want, and he's melding it with the sensibilities and the backdrop of 2001 and fusing some of those themes as well. And that's an extraordinary thing to do. You're taking two of the most gargantuan human odysseys ever committed to film, or print, and trying to find common ground between them. And he does. And that's what's really extraordinary to me. I loved every second of this film. We're having kind of a lunophilia moment where, you know, on the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, we're back into space and we're looking at landing on the moon again, and where everyone is kind of infatuated with that world again. And it's recreated here in a way that I've never seen before. And I just think every performance here, every nuance, every detail is just pitch perfect for me.
Ad Astra, Claudia.
I did not love every second of this film. I did like some of it. I didn't dislike this film, but I found it more inert than compelling. I thought it had visually some moments of great beauty. And I felt like the father-son story was what interested me more, but it felt too little explored and even occasionally kind of trite. I understand that it was, you know, he was trying to do Heart of Darkness in space. I just felt like it had kind of an episodic structure that didn't quite come together for me. I found the lead performances strong. I mean, of course, Brad Pitt was good in it. It was very, very low-key. But the story unspooled so slowly that I actually was bored some of the times. And I felt that the plot points felt a little disjointed and vague. And I felt that everybody who wasn't Brad Pitt in the movie was not given enough of a story. Ruth Negga, Liv Tyler, Donald Sutherland, they kind of just popped in, and there just wasn't enough development of all those other characters. So, you know, and I kept making comparisons to Gravity or Interstellar. I found comparisons there. It just didn't work for me.
All right. Ad Astra, the film starring Brad Pitt and Tommy Lee Jones, James Gray, the director and co-screenwriter with Ethan Gross, rated PG-13 in wide release. Downton Abbey, the period drama that was television series extraordinarily popular, now moves to the big screen. Michael Engler directs. Julian Fellowes, who was the showrunner, the screenwriter here, the film following the wealthy Crawley family as they await a visit from the king and queen to Downton Abbey. Fans of the TV show recognize many of the cast members, including Maggie Smith, Elizabeth McGovern, and Penelope Wilton.
Seems rather a waste of money.
Oh, here we go.
Isn't that what the monarchy's for? To brighten the lives of the nation with stateliness and glamour?
To quote Tennyson, kind hearts are more than coronets and simple faith than Norman blood.
Will you have enough cliches to get you through the visit?
If not, I'll come to you.
Downton Abbey, the film. Love that clip. Claudia, what'd you think?
That was a perfect clip to show. I, full disclosure, I'm a big fan of the show. I watched it all and then some, probably over, you know, a couple of times. The writing can be so much fun. And Maggie Smith's little bone mows are everything. And they are in full regalia here. They are just plentiful, more than usual. Yes, it was predictable. You know, the story, they brought in this kind of broad storyline of having the king and queen come to visit and, you know, everybody scurrying around. And but it did create interesting plot points for both the aristocracy and their servants. And it's very satisfying. It's sort of like, you know, a good cup of tea and some warm slippers. It's, you know, you have Tom.
Well said.
You have Tom Branson, the former Irish firebrand, who gets a new plot line. You have Edith looking more glamorous than morose. You have Maggie Smith, of course, with all those great zingers. Imelda Staunton joins the family as a distant cousin. And then you have all, you know, the usual sort of locking of horns between Penelope Stilton as Isabel and Violet, Granny. And then, you know, if you loved old Carson, he's back. And Mr. Thomas Barrow actually gets a really interesting storyline.
Great storyline.
Wonderful storyline. And then Daisy and Mrs. Patmore get a little bit more than usual. I feel like the Earl of Grantham and Lady Grantham got a little bit less. And the dog got a lot less. There was a new dog that no one really paid any attention to.
The kids are growing up.
Yes,
the grandkids
yes.
are growing up.
Yeah, but it worked for me. I thought it distilled, you know, so many of the ingredients that made the show so beloved.
Charles, what'd you think?
Well, I enjoyed it. I wasn't as big a fan of the series, but I think it has some problems. There are too many subplots, and there are many too many endings. There are about eight of them, and they don't need all of those. There are several lines where you think, okay, that's a good line to end on, and then, oh, we're back for something else. Of course, I bow to no one in adoring Maggie Smith, and when she announces something like, I don't argue, I explain, you know, you get this frisson of delight. A lot of the story is driven by whenever the King of England, as many of the older monarchs did, wherever he goes, he is at home and in residence. So his own servants come and take over. And of course, the Downton servants are furious and not being allowed to serve the king and being turned out of their own places. Lots of fun. What this felt to me like, a lot like to me, though, was that this is a transitional piece that they're probably thinking about a new season or seasons, and that certain of the actors want out. And it looks like the focus is switching to the Irish character,
Thomas Branson.
And that they've introduced an interesting new character with Imelda Staunton, who was also wonderful to put up against Maggie Smith, because, you know, the two of them can out-act anybody.
It's like a Harry Potter reunion.
And out-arch anybody.
Yeah.
So that's lots of fun, and it's interesting, but I wouldn't be surprised if this follows with something with the focus
maybe another
shifting.
Movie. I think maybe another movie.
Possibly another movie.
Yeah, Wade, what'd you think?
I love it, and I'm a fan of the series, too. I've seen every episode probably at least twice, and some of them maybe three times. There's something inherently very smart about Downton Abbey that it doesn't get enough credit for, and this goes to Julian Fellowes, and it's the baby bathwater factor to it, which is that this is a show essentially it's set against a very compelling historical backdrop. You've had World War I and the flu epidemic, and they even mention Hitler at one point when as a young politician in Germany, and there are all of these things happening in the actual historical backdrop. And that is meant to communicate to us, obviously, the loss of a certain Edwardian moment, a certain part of Edwardian culture that we know would soon fade away. But at the same time, Julian Fellowes is very aware of the fact that we are letting certain things go with it that we shouldn't. We should try to preserve certain things, certain sense of respect and dignity
civility.
And manner and civility. And that there are things in the culture that you should not let fade away, even as that sort of tradition, as those traditions of the aristocracy go away.
This and from the inhabitant of Wade Abbey.
Yes. And he wants us to consider that. And every second of the show and every second of this movie is pleading with us, yes, you do. There, you should be melancholy that some of this is going away. You should be glad that we're taking a step toward modernity, but don't throw away the things that really, really matter. And it's a wonderful plea, and it gets in our heart. And these characters have found their ways into our heart.
And they find a way of weaving in the modernity, too, with
yes.
With Thomas's character.
Very much.
I thought that was a really interesting Thomas Barrow's character, who started out as a villain early on
mm-hmm.
and has kind of, you know, expanded. We see what he was suffering, being gay and all of that. And I thought his character arc was fascinating.
Now that he's butler and he's more assertive,
yes.
and there's that wonderful moment where Lord Grantham is impressed by him, that he talks back, and
yes.
you just think, and it Julian Fellowes knows these characters as if they were members of his own family, and he writes them so beautifully, and he doesn't try to overreach. He's not trying to make this the summation, the big capper of the Downton saga. He says, no. These are basically two more episodes. We had some more money to spend, so we upped the ante and we upped the production value. But I'm gonna keep this story going as long as I can, and we may get another movie or two or three. Who knows?
All right, Downton Abbey, the film, directed by Michael Engler, Julian Fellowes, who created the television series and was the showrunner of the series, the screenwriter here. It's rated PG in wide release. The documentary Diego Maradona tells the story of the great Argentinian player who had a remarkable life as well. Over 500 hours of never-before-seen footage of Diego Maradona are included both on and off the field. Wade, what'd you think of the doc?
I thought it was extraordinary. I am a longtime fan of Asif Kapadia. I've interviewed him a few times all the way back to 2001 with his debut film, The Warrior, which was a UK submission in the foreign language category and got caught in the Miramax library, the Miramax closet at that time. And he fought his way out of that career setback as a great documentarian. Senna being the crowning achievement of his career.
Amy
the Amy Winehouse doc. Amazing,
yeah.
Amy. I think this is very much in the same vein as those. It's hard for me to say if this is better. It might be. I'm a little bit biased because here's one of my favorite filmmakers in the world making a documentary about a character I absolutely loathe. I am a huge soccer fan, and I rooted against Maradona every second of the late 80s and early 90s. I found myself remarkably compelled by this story. It doesn't make him any less of a villain or any more of a hero than he already is to everyone. everyone else, but it does try to get inside that villain-hero dichotomy that made Maradona such a mercurial figure for so long. And you learn a great deal about him, and the archival footage is stunning. I don't know where they came up with some of it. It must have been a needle in a haystack effort to come up with some of this material. But what an amazing tapestry. And it's and the craft of it is quite beautiful. It's entirely done. All the interviews are done in voiceover. You don't see the interview subjects. They simply narrate this footage, which is, you know, compiled in what must have been an editorial undertaking of epic proportions. Quite an impressive film.
What do you think, Claudia?
I was also very impressed by it. And I'm also a huge fan of Asif Kapadia. But we approach it from very different angles because I am not a football / soccer fan. I'd never heard of Diego Maradona. I've only heard of, like, Pelé and, David Beckham. So yeah. I'm so not a soccer person. So he was a name that meant nothing to me. So I didn't go into it with any kind of hate or rancor. I just was like, okay, let's see who this guy is. And the thing about Asif Kapadia, I think, is he can make anyone interesting. He can make, you know, someone who is – he just has a way. He's such a great filmmaker, and he is so – he's so fascinated by the idea of a rise and fall and how much early fame, you know, whether it was Senna, whether it was Amy Winehouse, whether it's him. And that, and this is almost like a part of the third part of a trilogy of exploring, you know, what can happen to you with early fame and the tragedies that can befall you.
They're like Greek tragedies.
They are like Greek tragedies. Yeah. And if you read about it somewhere, it's almost like he's a novelistic figure. And I felt a lot of compassion for him. I felt really badly for him because he was this guy from extreme poverty in Buenos Aires. And then he is, you know, picked up and plucked into this, and he's deified. I mean, they literally deified. They have, you know, they put his picture up and, you know, in the churches of Naples, and he's made into this saint. And then he is brought down, and they call him Lucifer and Satan. So, I mean, it's talk about a rise and fall. It's just such a dramatic rise and fall. And it's such a great match of filmmaker and subject, I think. He has a way of looking at early success and its tragic consequences that I think is just so probing. And he doesn't, you know, do the kind of narration. He just lets the story tell itself with all his amazing footage.
I will say my one reservation is they give the 1990 World Cup rematch between Germany and Argentina, where Germany beat Argentina and denied him back-to-back World Cup wins, which only Pelé has ever done before. That was given very short shrift. I wish they had spent more time to just satisfy my sense of vengeance from 1990.
Just for you.
Just for me.
The documentary is titled The Name of Its Subject, Diego Maradona. Asif Kapadia is the director of the documentary. You can see it at Lemley's Glendale Theater. It also, beginning in October, will be shown on HBO and streaming on HBO Now. The film is unrated. We have much more to come on Film Week. Reviews of Rambo Last Blood. Yes, Sylvester Stallone is back as that character. And the documentary Moonlight Sonata. Film Week on KPCC. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Charles Solomon, Claudia Puig, and Wade Major. Next up, Rambo Last Blood. Sylvester Stallone is back in that role of Rambo. Adrian Grunberg is the director, and Matthew Cerulnik is the screenwriter along with Sylvester Stallone. Claudia?
Was I am actually glad I saw it, so that I can warn people away from seeing it. And I would actually urge people, particularly Latinos who are a major segment of the movie going public, to boycott it because it is so racist. In addition to being offensive in its sadism, the director, Adrian Grunberg, made a film called Get the Gringo. This one could be called Get the Mexican. Half the movie takes place in Mexico, and Mexicans are largely portrayed, with the exception of one, and we're talking many, many others, portrayed as vicious, uber-violent, foul-mouthed, and the darker skin they are, the more evil they are. The only positive thing I can say about it is that it's a blessed 89 minutes. So there's that. But there's no reason for this movie to exist. It's gory, it's grotesque, it's vicious, it's, as mentioned, it's offensive. It's so not the movie we need in these times of racial hatred and excessive gun violence. And I realize that he's a cartoonish character, but the storyline is that he has this kind of daughter figure. She's not a daughter, but a family he's sort of taken in, and they're Mexican-American, and she goes down to find her father in Mexico. They never say what town or anything. And she gets kidnapped essentially for sort of sex trafficked. And the very real problem of human trafficking is both glossed over and exploited in the way that they do this. And it's just used as kind of a convenient plot point for him to, mete out all his torturous, vengeant acts. And his barbarism really knows no bounds here. He is, you know, his torture includes decapitating, pulling bones and organs out of people's bodies, impaling people. You know, you think of some obscure, it's sort of like, what was that movie that was The Many Ways to Die? Well, there's been a few of those, but it's like Saw. I mean, it has that kind of, it's actually stomach churning, and it's jingoistic, and it's really badly written. He co-wrote it. He should really stick to Rocky. There's a line where he says, "I know how black a man's heart is, and you know, I'm just trying to keep a lid on it every day." And you only wish that he had kept a lid on it.
Rambo: Last Blood in wide release. It's rated R. The documentary Moonlight Sonata: Deafness in Three Movements is directed by Irene Taylor Brodsky. Claudia,
I love this documentary. It's interesting because we're looking at, I think, three different documentaries this week, and each one of them has a very different style. When you look at Asif Kapadia's style, you know, it's compiling mass amounts of archival footage and letting that tell the story and excavating all those. In this film, Irene Taylor Brodsky does a kind of a cinema verite, but also home movie style of film, in which she uses her son and her parents as the subjects to explore deafness, and not as a tragedy that befalls you, but as sort of perhaps it's something to retreat into. Perhaps people who have the option of actually tuning out the world and going into a quiet place have an advantage. And she connects her son, who is going deaf and has a cochlear implant, with her parents, who were born deaf or were deaf ever since she knew them, since she came into the world. And they also have cochlear implants, but at times they just turn them off because they, you know, are soothed by the quiet. And I just felt this was really beautifully done. It asked fascinating questions about the world around us, and I loved the viewpoints, and I liked how it interwove Beethoven, who her son has a great love for. He loves the piece Moonlight Sonata. He wants to play it in a recital, and he's a normal kind of kid, so he's an interesting subject. He's not a prodigy or a genius.
About how old's the kid?
11.
Okay.
And he's a typical kid in that sometimes he's kind of lazy and doesn't want to practice, and other times he, you know, talks back and gets emotional. But he also has this beautiful bond with her father, with his grandfather. And it's really wonderful to see that, and to see it from so up close and intimate a view that she takes. I found it a really interesting documentary.
We're talking about Moonlight Sonata: Deafness in Three Movements. Wade?
Everything Claudia said and more. It is deeply moving. And because it is so personal, it makes its points, I think, with greater moral authority than if the filmmaker were someone simply approaching this subject from the outside. Very personal to me. My mother would have been deaf if not for the Stapes surgery. She was one of the first to get those back in the 1950s. And
grandmother too.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, that was before cochlear. There was that, and that was, and it did very much the same thing at the same time. And then it migrates to treating the issue of dementia, which is kind of a surprising turn in the film. And I'm not giving anything necessarily away, but, you know, I've done two tours as a dementia caregiver as well. And those two subjects together kind of represent an enormous challenge for an increasing number of people in society. And that's why I was grateful for it. You know, every year the number of people who are dealing with dementia and hearing loss, whether it's straight up deafness or just, you know, the aging process and the toll that it takes on hearing, we're getting millions and millions more. And the generation that is having to deal with that is getting older and older themselves. And to have someone so close to both of those things here share her experience is edifying, and it is strengthening. And I think it's a vital film and really important, and it arrives at a great moment in time.
Charles, what do you think of Moonlight Sonata?
I wasn't edified and I wasn't strengthened, because I think this film is lacking terribly in structure and focus. It begins with a very interesting idea that because the boy gets his cochlear implants when he's quite young, he has a different relationship to sound and to what it means and to how to interpret it than the filmmaker's parents do, who only got them very late in life and grew up in an absence of sound and really have trouble perceiving it and what it means. The problem of grandpa developing dementia is a completely different subject. It's not linked to deafness. It should have been another film, and I think this degenerates into sitting through her home movies.
I don't see how you could have made another film because that was what was happening.
But it's irrelevant to the subject of deafness.
But it's not irrelevant to a family. And I think if you're going to turn the camera on your family.
If this is about her family, what about the other two little boys and her husband who get cut out except to make some noise in the background?
All right, the film Moonlight Sonata, Deafness in Three Movements, Irene Taylor-Brodsky, the director. It's unrated. It's at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. Also out this week, the documentary Where's My Roy Cohn, directed by Matt Tiernauer. This is about the controversial attorney best known for being Senator Joseph McCarthy's chief counsel during the McCarthy hearings of 1954.
Roy Cohn began this whole new mode of what you see today of get off the issue, attack law enforcement, attack the government, attack the press, create phony issues so that you can totally change the debate.
Here's a little McCarthyism going on right
now.
He shouldn't
disclaim, a total inability to cope with any of these current topics. He does it with great precision.
This is known as filler. You know, you throw your mud and then the filler goes on until they've forgotten what the point was.
Where's My Roy Cohn? The documentary, Matt Tiernauer is the director. Claudia?
I thought this was a fascinating documentary. The format of this documentary is a much more straightforward with talking heads.
Still a rise and fall, though.
It is a rise and fall. Yeah. Well, yes, that's true. And Roy Cohn, of course, is an inherently fascinating subject for a documentary. I don't think it's necessarily a definitive film about him, because sometimes it feels like there's a checklist of his kind of greatest hits or worst hits in his case. I found it more intriguing as a character study of the American zeitgeist and kind of, you know, that Roy Cohn was the common thread going back to the 50s, going back to Senator Joe McCarthy and going up to Donald Trump. And Trump was his protege. And that was, to me, one of the most interesting parts. And that certainly was focused on by Matt Tiernauer, who did Studio 54 last year and has done Citizen Jane, has done some good documentaries. I enjoyed it completely. I mean, I would love to count how many times I heard the words manipulative, Machiavellian, you know, mm-hmm. power mad, all those things. But he was all those things. And then one of his cousins says, he was an evil produced by certain currents in the American culture. And people, you know, I loved that. I think the most interesting observations came from people who were closest to him, which makes perfect sense.
His
former lover, his cousins, his colleagues, Roger Stone. That was interesting. And it's, you know, the connection to Trump I thought was fascinating because he taught him certain things like, never admit to anything, lie if you have to. There were actual, you know, little homilies that he seemed to have given him to, you know, turn things around, make something about something else if you're being focused on, because he represented him and Fred Trump back in
over the real estate,
civil rights issue. And I like that they looked back and, you know, they said he loved pulling the levers of power and he got a taste for it early in life. At 15 years old, he made his first bribe. He got a teacher out of traffic school when he was in high school. I mean, he was making wheeling and dealing from the minute he came
born
out of the womb.
Yeah. Where's My Roy Cohn, Wade?
It's a terrific doc. I think I like Citizen Jane of all of Matt Tiernauer's films. I like Citizen Jane the most. It is the most cohesive and self-contained story. I think that's a wonderful doc. But, you know, and Claudia said, is it definitive? I don't know that you can be definitive of Roy Cohn. You're talking about one of the most complex and conflicted and mythic. Talk about Greek tragedy.
Yes.
There's so much going
He's
on here.
He's a contradiction unto himself.
There's
I
was so wondering much if you could even make a documentary about it.
Yeah. There's so much to unpack. Things that I didn't know, you know, the arranged marriage of his parents. So much about what does it mean for him to be Jewish? What does it mean for him as a gay man who refused to admit that he was gay, even as he's dying
kind of
from
a self-hating Jew and a self-hating gay
exactly.
man.
Exactly.
Yeah. I was astonished to learn from Claudia he had a lover.
Oh, well.
Well, but I think the one
lot.
That was interviewed, yeah. And he had a type. It was very much a kind of a waspish Germanic.
Yes, the Nordic type.
Nordic, yeah.
And you know, the fact that there he is clearly dying from AIDS and still refusing, just in the face of all evidence and knowledge to the contrary will not allow that to be a reality that's associated with him. There's a lot to unpack psychologically. I don't think the film unpacks all of it, but it doesn't need to. It gets us interested enough. It piques our curiosity. It restores him into the middle of a cultural conversation at a time when I think we need to talk about him. The two things that I think are an unfortunate drawback, one, are the two people that they needed to interview to create a more complete portrait, which is Donald Trump and Barbara Walters. Neither of them are here.
I didn't know about the Barbara Walters connection.
Oh, I did. I remember that very well.
I have a whole new view of her now.
Yeah, well.
And that's not good.
and so sort of without them, I Trump doesn't really show up until the last third of the film. I think they maybe try to connect Roy Cohn too much to explain Donald Trump, because Trump was already Trump when he met Cohn. It was on more a meeting of the minds.
But he sought advice from him, and then Cohn said to him, go on the defensive and attack the government, attack the press,
but Trump
create
was already,
phony issues.
He was already doing that at that time anyway.
But he sort of maybe
he may have reinforced it. Yeah.
The film Where's My Roy Cohn at the ArcLight Hollywood, the Landmark in West L.A. It's rated PG-13. The Swedish comedic drama Britt Marie Was Here is directed by Tuva Nadvatny, she's one of the screenwriters as well. Wade?
Love this film. Stars Pernilla August, who's married to Billy August, and who starred in Billy August, The Best Intentions, which won the Cannes Film Festival 25 years ago. And she is wonderful. This is two genres in one. It's the old age looking to restart your life genre and the underdog sports genre. She's an older woman whose marriage falls apart, and she winds up getting a job coaching a youth's soccer team of primarily immigrant and poor kids. And she has no experience in soccer, knows nothing about it.
It's the second soccer movie of the week.
It is. And it's formula, but it's charming.
Yes, it's charming. It's pleasant. It's light. She's great. I thought she had a very restrained lead performance. She was very genial. And it avoids being maudlin or sugary sweet. So it worked.
Sounds like kind of film might have some, for a foreign language film, commercial potential.
I can totally see it being remade in the English language and maybe Imelda Staunton
Absolutely.
Starring in it, or Jerry Jones if it was American. Yeah,
yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of appeal in the concept.
Oh, yes.
Britt Marie Was Here, a Swedish film. You can see it at a number of the Lemley theaters here in Southern California. It's unrated. Coming up, we have many more films to talk about with our critics. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Wonderful to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. A lot of movies out this week. We're taking you through them one by one. I'm joined by critics Charles Solomon, Wade Major, and Claudia Puig. Next up is the Japanese animated sci-fi film Promare. It's directed by Hiroyuki Imaishi. Charles, what'd you think of this?
This is great fun and the film for anime fans this weekend. Imaishi created Gurren Lagann, a very popular series. And what I love about this movie is, after complaining here and in print about how much the same American animated films have started to look, that everything is so detailed and you see every hair and every stitch in the sweater, this feels closer to Yellow Submarine. The palette is day-glow. It just explodes onto the screen in this kind of spin wheel of action and activity and fights and battles. It's set in a kind of dystopic future where one section of humanity became burnished, people who could manipulate fire. They were defeated in a series of battles. Now they're rising again under a charismatic new leader. And this puts them in opposition to Gaylo Thamos, the hit great fireman hero figure, who's very much like one of the Gurren Lagann characters. He charges in. You know, a guy's got to do what a guy's got to do. He's silly. He's funny. He's over the top. And again, after these hyper-realistic characters, to see a film that just revels in being drawn, even more, I think, than Spider-Verse did, it's just fun and refreshing and very different. And if you're at all interested in anime or in just how far you can push design and color, this is the film for you.
Is this for you one of the top animated films of the year?
I like its originality and excitement. It's not the greatest storytelling in the world or dealing with any maybe serious issues, but it's a lot of fun.
Promare is the film. It's rated PG-13 in select theaters. Augie, a sci-fi drama, stars Richard Kind and Kristen Harper. Matt Cain is the director and co-screenwriter with Mark Underhill. Wade?
This is quite a smart little independent film. This is kind of a low-budget independent version of Her, the Oscar-winning Spike Jonze film of some years ago. Richard Kind is a guy who's just basically been laid off. He's redundant now at his job. And what's he going to do with the rest of his life at a very moment when his wife's career is taking off? He feels disconnected. He feels useless. And one of the parting gifts that they give him at his job are these virtual reality glasses. That's the sci-fi part of this, where when you put them on, you see a companion, a virtual companion, and in this case, a beautiful young woman who understands him and she knows him. And it's all kind of coming out of his own mind. And she winds up becoming basically someone he has an affair with, a virtual affair. She disconnects him from his family and from the real world. And he loses himself in this fake relationship. And the film is very smart about how it approaches this. It's not a sensational thing. It doesn't overplay the sexual aspect of it. And Richard Kind is such a good character actor. You know, he goes back so far. It's great to see him get a role where he gets to be the lead and not the comic relief. And it's sad and it's touching and it's provocative and it's quite a good little film.
And a directorial debut for Matt Cain.
Yep.
Augie, the film, it's unrated. It's at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica. Also can be seen on video on demand. The Wedding Year, comedy starring Sarah Hyland and Tyler James Williams. Robert Luketic is the director, and Donald Diego wrote the screenplay. Claudia.
This is a pretty slight romantic comedy. It feels like something you would see on TV. It feels like some of the lesser Netflix romantic comedies that have been out. It's fine. It's a way to spend a couple hours. I wouldn't, you know, rush out to see it. But Robert Luketic, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, directed Legally Blonde. So, you know, he certainly knows how to do romantic comedy. The stars, Sarah Hyland and Tyler James Williams, are very likable and they have a certain amount of chemistry. She was one of the key characters on Modern Family, one of the young girls. He was in Everybody Hates Chris. So these are, you know, definitely actors from popular TV series. And it's about two people who are on the lists of they're at that age where everybody's getting married. And so they're on the list. They're constantly being asked to go to weddings. And then they fall for each other and decide to get married. And it's all the things that happen to sort of get in the way of that. So it's, you know, it feels like we may have seen this before. But they do have a nice chemistry. And they're an interracial couple. And that's never particularly brought up. But they don't make a whole lot out of that, which is a nice thing. So there's some forced moments, but in general, there are moments when there's some humor to it too. So it's a middling romantic comedy, I would say.
The Wedding Year, the romantic comedy, and Robert Luketic, the director, did direct Legally Blonde, Ugly Truth, and 21. Donald Diego wrote the screenplay. It's rated R in select theaters. The thriller American Dreamer stars Jim Gaffigan, Robbie Jones. It's directed by Derek Bort, who co-wrote the screenplay with Daniel Fort. Wade, what'd you think of American Dreamer?
Yet another offspring from Taxi Driver. We get these every so often, and they're all kind of doing the same thing. And very often they star comics who are trying to cut their chops as dramatic actors. Jim Gaffigan is really, really good here. He's an unstable guy whose marriage has disintegrated, and she has a restraining order against him. And he can't see his child, and he's basically driving an Uber. And winds up driving around a drug dealer and gets some ideas based on being a little bit too acquainted with this drug dealer as to how he can turn his life around. Well, naturally, all his ideas of turning his life around are wrong, and they just create one catastrophe after another, and everything winds up, as in Taxi Driver, going very, very dark. It's not necessarily surprising. It's not always logical. It takes some turns that feel very, very contrived. But you're watching this basically to watch Gaffigan work and do something that we've never seen him do before. And in that regard, it's very rewarding.
Claudia, what do you think of American Dreamer?
In that regard, I think he's playing against type, and he shows that he's a good dramatic actor.
Yeah.
He also looks a lot like Philip Seymour Hoffman in Before the Devil Knows You're Dead.
Oh, he does.
Doesn't
he? Yes, he
Which
does.
Which is a fantastic movie. I would recommend people go back and see Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, and maybe not this one. but, you know, some of the problems I had with the plot, I think he does a pretty good job, but the choice that they make of how he is going to get money from this drug dealer, and the drug dealer is pretty stereotypically
There's some pretty big jumps of logic.
And it's pretty disturbing in terms of child imperilment and all that. So I have some mixed feelings about this, but I do think it definitely shows his dramatic acting chops.
American Dreamer, starring Jim Gaffigan, Derek Bort, the director and co-screenwriter. Film is rated R. It's at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica. Primal is a TV series, but is getting a theatrical release for this action animated film. It's created by Genndy Tartakovsky. Charles, what do you think of Primal?
Well, I'm a huge admirer of Genndy Tartakovsky, who brought us Dexter's Laboratory and Samurai Jack, and have whined on this show in the past about he deserves something better than the Hotel Transylvania movies and propping up Adam Sandler. And this is Genndy going back to being Genndy. I didn't love it as much as I do Samurai Jack, but it's told entirely in mime with sound effects. The graphics are striking and original and minimal. Gorgeous backgrounds. It's not terribly scientific, because you have a caveman who's lost his family, and a small theropod carnivorous dinosaur who's lost his, and they sort of bond and struggle for existence in this very violent world. This is not a cartoon for kids at all, but Genndy is such a skillful director and just makes the material interesting, communicates even with minimal animation through body language and expression. And it's just fun to see him doing something on his own that he does so well. So I really enjoyed it.
Now, is this episodic at all? Because it's television?
Yeah, it's basically, I assume, the first four episodes of a series. I certainly hope there are more. I really like three of them. One I wasn't quite so high on. But I hope this is something that's continuing, because again, we need this kind of original voice and vision.
Do we know if he has an outlet yet on TV?
It's going to be, I believe, on Cartoon Network.
All right. This chance to see it on the big screen at the Downtown Independent, downtown Los Angeles, week-long run initiating on Saturday. Primal TV series, but to be shown theatrically at Downtown Independent, is rated TVMA for mature audiences. Coming up, we'll hear what Claudia thinks of the thriller Imprisoned. She also saw Villains. Boy, she's getting all these tough films. That's why you roll brass knuckles into the studio. We'll continue with Film Week in 1 minute.
There's been a lot of heat about climate change.
AOC's climate change con.
After Sandy, you don't find a lot of climate change deniers in New York City.
So with hundreds of journalists and researchers around the world, we're shedding light on the topic with a week of special reports. The facts about what's happening, why it's happening, and what can be done.
One little thing you can do on your little piece of land is to create some habitat.
Covering climate now, all this week on 89.3 KPCC.
Wonderful to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics this week, Wade Major, Claudia Puig, Charles Solomon. And Claudia, continuing with her theme of all these rough films, next up has the thriller Imprisoned, starring Juan Pablo Rava. It's written and directed by Paul Kampf. Claudia?
Maybe I need a romantic comedy. Yeah, right. Well, you know, this was well-meaning in its condemnation of capital punishment, but it's pretty dully executed. It has a great cast, and I wish it had been better. And ultimately, they dedicated to the indomitable spirit of the Puerto Rican people, which I thought was wonderful. Intrinsically, this is kind of an interesting story, but it ends up being flat and kind of – it's both flat and overheated. It alternates between both of those, which is – neither of them are good. And it's kind of generic, and it's being sort of a prison thriller. There's some very good performances. It's got a great cast, including Edward James Olmos, Issa Morales, Lawrence Fishburne. Lawrence Fishburne speaks damn good Spanish. I was very impressed
That's
by
interesting.
That.
Interesting.
A whole lot better than Sylvester Stallone, I will say.
Is the whole film in Spanish or mixed?
Yes, mixed. It's largely in Spanish. And it's this, you know, prison melodrama, and he's framed for the main guy is originally – he was responsible for, I don't want to give too much away, for the death of Lawrence Fishburne's loved ones. And so he ends up framing him for another crime, and then he ends up being on death row, essentially. And by the way, Puerto Rico hasn't had capital punishment since 1929. It was abolished.
Is the prison in Puerto Rico or the States?
The prison is in Puerto Rico.
It's in Puerto
Rico. Yeah, okay. And it looks very much like an Alcatraz. It's on this like, sort of very dramatic coastline. And the last time they had a hanging was in 1927. This was not taking place then. But it has some fairly heavy-handed symbolism. And then sort of the emotional parts feel a little bit overwrought. But so I feel like it was more of a admirable effort than it was, ultimately a good thriller, unfortunately.
Imprisoned is the film. Paul Kampf, the writer-director. It's rated R at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. Claudia also saw Villains, a comedic horror movie written and directed by Dan Burke and Robert Olson.
This is a fairly funny black comedy. It's kind of a love story and a twisted, very twisted love story. And it's fairly entertaining and offbeat. It involves a kidnapping, a very twisted suburban couple played by Kyra Sedgwick and Jeffrey Donovan. And it's this black comedy, and the scenario is kind of a surprise. You have these two young couple who are very, in love, and they are also criminals, but their crime is more like, holding up a convenience store. And then they, through a series of events, they end up in this house where they're trying to kind of figure out their next step because they've run out of gas, and things, the tables are turned on them, and it becomes a much more kind of threatening situation for them. And Bill Skarsgård plays one of the felons, and Micah Monroe, who's really quite good. It's a fun movie. I mean, it's nicely assembled. There's a great production design. The house looks like something out of sort of the Brady Bunch, or maybe even earlier, kind of the 60s. And the people sort of seem cryogenically frozen from the 50s and 60s, the couple. So it's fun. It's, nothing great, but it's fairly kind of a little bit unusual in sort of how it's twisting up the crime thriller genre.
Villains is in select theaters. It's rated R. Also, it's the 25th anniversary of The Shawshank Redemption. Tim Robbins and Morgan Freeman star in the film. Frank Darabont, the writer-director of the series, before he'd go on to do The Walking Dead on TV. Wade, take us back to what you particularly like about Shawshank.
I love The Shawshank Redemption. It came at a particularly I had just begun as a film critic at the time, so you're prepared to go in with daggers out every time you see a movie, and I couldn't find anything wrong with this film. It just washed over me in a really beautiful way, partly because I think it was based on a novella. Stephen King's books have always made for difficult translation to film because they are dense and they're thick and they're huge, like It, had two movies and it still doesn't encompass it all. This was a novella based on a Tolstoy story, and everything was there. And so Darabont had a lot to work with and time and space to let it breathe and let the characters become who they were. And I think it, speaking of capital punishment, it certainly has a lot to say about a lot of things, including the justice system, friendship, morality, ethics, and it does it all beautifully.
Your thoughts?
I agree completely with what you said. I remember just being really mesmerized by the performances of Tim Robbins and Morgan Freeman. That was what, and Morgan Freeman particularly, I remember just that is what stayed with me over the years.
Am I confusing this with something else, or is this where they play the aria from The Marriage of Figaro suddenly into the prison?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the only thing I remember.
And see it again.
Why 94 was a long time ago.
That's the Countess and Susanna plotting to undo the Count's evil, lecherous schemes. I don't understand what it was doing there.
The Shawshank Redemption is getting select theater screenings on Sunday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. You can check your local listings. It's rated R. Also, the documentary getting a re-release, Say Amen, Somebody, about the gospel music artists here in America circa 1982, a 4K restoration. Wade?
Beautiful documentary made when they didn't have video or all the tools we have today. This was on film. They had to make this doc. It's a beautiful documentary. It speaks to exactly how integral gospel music has been in American culture. culture, and especially for the American music industry, how many great artists we owe the gospel background to. And it's just the performances are wonderful. It's
maybe it's worth pairing with Amazing Grace.
Oh, for
sure. I was
sure.
just
yeah.
thinking that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was such a good film.
Say
oh, so
Amen,
good.
Somebody, which did quite well on the art house scene in 1982, is getting single-day screenings at a number of the Lemley theaters. Again, check Lemley's website or your local listings. The documentary is rated G. Also wanted to mention that Refugee, a short dramatic film that Wade, you were executive producer of, is getting a screening at
yes.
the Lemley Royal.
And my wife was one of the producers, and written and directed by Brant Anderson, who was a producer on Everest and Lone Survivor. And this is his writing and directing debut, a story of a this is our week, Oscar qualifying week. It's playing 4 p.m. From the 20th through the 26th at the Lemley Royal. Story of a Syrian doctor who, with her daughter, is forced to become a refugee and flee their country. We worked hard on this, and we're very proud of it.
All right,
it'd be
congratulations!
So cool to have an Oscar
on
winner
that.
On Film Week. How good would that
cool.
be?
He wouldn't come back to us.
Yes, he'd be too big for us.
I used to do that show. Brant Anderson, the writer director of Refugee. The short film. Also want to remind you that our next Film Week screening is of the terrific sci-fi film Blade Runner from Ridley Scott. We're going to show the final cut. That's the one that Ridley Scott actually oversaw. We'll show it on the big screen theater at Ace Hotel Saturday night, November 2nd at 7 p.m. We have a great post-film conversation talking about the movie afterwards. And you probably don't remember, but Blade Runner was set in 2019 Los Angeles. So as we get set to say goodbye to 2019, we're going to do it with a film showing dystopia of Los Angeles in this very year. Things, of course, very different. But nonetheless, great chance for us to enjoy a classic film. The series devoted to movies that are set in Los Angeles. You can get your tickets at kpcc.org/in-person. From all of us at Film Week, have a wonderful weekend.